G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for Science Friction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's a Saturday night in Canberra, late 1999. 72-year-old Irma and her husband, Gregor, are settling down in front of the TV. Gregor gets up for the bathroom, but as he turns into the hallway, he's confronted by two masked intruders. What happens next leaves a family grieving, sparks a decades-long investigation, and ultimately leads to this murder trial. I'm Stephen Stockwell. A word of warning, this episode contains descriptions of violence. Welcome to the case of the two intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
For more than 20 years, police have searched for the person who murdered Irma Palasik. And now two men are on trial in the Canberra Supreme Court. Elizabeth Byrne is the ABC's court reporter in Canberra, has been doing that job for decades. Elizabeth, welcome back to the case of.
Thanks, Stocky.
Liz, as I mentioned, you have been working in Canberra for decades. I would say you're probably the ABC's most experienced court reporter, but you actually covered Irma's murder in 1999 as a general reporter, not doing courts, just as, you know, an ABC reporter covering the stories that were happening at the time. Can you talk me through what happened?
Well, essentially what happened was that on November the 6th, 1999, it was a significant day in Australia because that was the day we all voted in the referendum on a republic. At about 8 o'clock or so in the evening, Irma and Gregor Palasik were sort of settling down to watch a bit of TV. Irma went and had a shower and got ready for bed and came out. And Gregor was on the couch. He got up to go and use the bathroom himself. And as he got up, he saw two men rush into the house. This is his account. He says that one of them attacked him and the other attacked Irma. He couldn't see where Irma went, but he could hear her screaming for some time. He said he was beaten himself, and his attacker said to him, "Where's the money? Where's the money?" And things went on from there. The house was ransacked and some money was stolen from an area in the kitchen. And then after a while, the men left and Mr. Palasik, Gregor Palasik, freed himself and then went to his wife's aid. Now, after a while, her screaming had stopped, and when he found her, she was dead.
Oh, God. Such a brutal interaction as well. You know, a quiet Saturday evening, sitting in front of the TV, the Republic referendum being that night, you know, you can understand why they would have been watching TV as well that night. This has been unsolved for so long, Liz, you know, quarter of a century. There must be such a strong appetite in Canberra, in the community, for some kind of resolution to this, right?
Well, there was, particularly from Irma and Gregor Palasik's family, and also from the police. So this case sort of bubbled along for a while. There was the police issued a reward for any information in about 2000. Mm-hmm. Then Irma's family had, there were placards that over of a poster that the police had had saying who killed Irma, and the in his opening address, the prosecutor, Trent Hickey, had drawn the jury's attention to that. He said, you may remember the who killed Irma signs. Mm. And that went on for a number of years, on and off, but nothing came to light over that time until much more recently.
Yeah, right. I'm keen to get into kind of how this story has unfolded and what we've learned basically over the prosecution openings. You know, one of the most significant parts of a trial is the opening statements. It's when we learn a huge amount about how you know, the prosecution says an offence occurred, why it says the people that it has in the dock are the people that are guilty of this crime. So it's the whole prosecution case. And, you know, you mentioned there in the opening, the, you know, the prosecutor talking about the Who Killed Irma posters, you know, a huge story in Canberra through this period. And, you know, it seems that the motive being presented is one that is a search for money, right? You know, there was money that was taken in the robbery in 1999, but you know, we heard in the openings that wasn't the only robbery. It wasn't even the second time they had been robbed. In fact, they'd been robbed a number of times over the years prior. Can you tell me a bit about, you know, what the court heard about, you know, the years leading up to this 1999 robbery?
Well, initially, Irma and Gregor Palasics lived in a suburb called Red Hill, in a house there, and they were robbed in that house twice. Mm. Once was in 1997. They were out, and so they didn't see who came. Mm. It emerged, though, and this was told to the jury, that they had taken $102,000 in cash, which had been stashed under the house.
A huge amount of money in 1997.
Enough to buy a house. But that money, it was in a couple of different places, but mostly in a biscuit tin, and it was very well hidden. So underneath the house, everything was, you know, torn apart. Mm. And that money was taken, and of course the police called, but there was no indication as to who might have done that. Mm. Then in 1998, Irma Palasics went out her back door to get a lemon and was confronted in her backyard by a man in a balaclava. Now, he punched her in the face. This has all been put before the jury. He punched her in the face. She fell to the ground. He continued to punch her. She pulled his balaclava off and threw it away. And then as he got up to run away, she saw a second man in a balaclava also run from the property, and those two people were never found, but the balaclava was there, so they had that.
Incredible tenacity, I suppose, from a woman in her 70s at this point. Irma and Gregor Palasics in their 70s at the time of these robberies, so kind of incredible for Irma to kind of fight back after being punched during this robbery, during a burglary of her house in Canberra in 1998. And the balaclava, Liz, I want to talk a little bit about, because, you know, that being recovered from the scene of the 1998 robbery sounds quite significant. You know, we're hearing in the openings a lot about, you know, DNA evidence as well as the balaclava. There was also DNA recovered from the robbery that Irma was killed during in 1999, but that actually wasn't something that was particularly useful to police at the time. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Now, the balaclava turned out to be very important. One of the things in the case is that there's the balaclava has since been destroyed, but there's tape lifts from it. Mm. And there was testing done. Mm. But it was 1999, and DNA, well, we thought in 1999 DNA testing was, you know, quite sophisticated, and it was compared to when it first started. But at that time, it wasn't able to be identified at all.
Right.
Flip forward to the 1999 robbery. Now, there were two sources of DNA recovered from that. One of them was from a water jug in the fridge at the Palasics house, and the other one was from a milk container, a milk carton in the fridge at the Palasics house. Now, over time, this was stepped, really. Mm. By 2014, DNA analysis was more advanced. Yep. And what police were able to ascertain is that DNA recovered from the balaclava matched one of the DNA samples found in 1999.
Right.
So thus far, they knew that there was a link, but they didn't know who belonged to that DNA.
Right. So we had the prosecution saying, you know, based on the testing, there's a high likelihood that the DNA profile from the balaclava is matching the DNA profile of someone who's taken a drink out of something in the fridge in the 1999 robbery.
That's right. And that's how the prosecution say that the robberies are linked.
Right.
Now, 2019, what happened was that police got confirmation that there was an unconfirmed link between a man called Steve Fabrizi's DNA and one of the DNA samples at the 1999 incident. And that eventually led to a major investigation.
Yeah, because we have Steve Fabrizi, now 70 years old, on trial for the murder of Irma Palasik. How did the police start working their way towards this second alleged offender who's also on trial?
Well, the police didn't run in and arrest him. okay. What they did was to develop a fairly sophisticated undercover operation, and they set up a fictitious criminal syndicate, which employed Steve Fabrizi to carry out certain tasks. Now, the prosecutor was very careful to say no crimes were committed in this process.
Okay.
But what they did was to draw him in. They remunerated him for some of the things that he did. And then eventually they indicated to him that they were in touch with a corrupt police officer who could get him out of trouble if he ever found himself in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Then eventually they revealed that his DNA had come up in a investigation into a murder in Canberra, and that's when things started to head towards where we are now. They confronted him with this information. There is, in fact, the prosecutor said, a videotape of the conversations, the main conversation Steve Fabrizi had with the fictitious head of the fictitious criminal syndicate. And at first he came up with one story, and then they told him, well, that's not very plausible. They said getting help from the corrupt police officer would be dependent on him actually telling the truth. So in the end, it's alleged he came out with that he'd been there and that the man he'd gone there with was a man called Joe, and his name was Vicon or something like that. So that's how the police were set off on the road to Joseph Vicconi, who is the second person charged over the murder.
Right. That's an incredible scene that you have painted, Liz. The, you know, a man who police suspect was involved in a robbery, you know, 20-something years previously. They build a fake criminal network around him and employ him into that, and then slowly gain his trust, I suppose, and start to draw this information out of him. I mean, what was the moment that police realised they had, you know, someone who could have been involved with this crime in 1999? Because it happened so long ago.
Well, in the case of Steve Fabrizi, they were fairly certain that they could put him at the scene, I guess. Mm. And this interview they did with him where they said, our help to you is contingent on the truth.
Mm.
And then, of course, when they were set off on this path to identify Joseph Vicconi, I think the critical thing there was the prosecution says they got his DNA eventually off from him and tested it against, remember, there were the two samples, one from a vessel out of the fridge at the Palasik and one from the balaclava. According to the prosecution, it's 100 billion times more likely to have been Joseph Vicconi's, and that's how he came to be identified by police.
Right, got it. And I mean, Liz, just thinking back to this scene in 1999, you know, police are, you know, working their way through the home of the Palasiks. You know, Irma Palasik has just been killed in that house that evening. They're working through and they're assessing that crime scene. I mean, how did they know to to swab a couple of bottles in the fridge.
Well, that was because Gregor Palasik told them that while he was tied up on the ground, he had seen one of the men at the fridge swigging something from a bottle. He glimpsed them.
Mm.
The word, and that's an important word because we'll hear from the defence lawyers later about that. But he glimpsed that happening. And so after he told police he'd seen that, they got the forensic scientists to go and check the fridge and swab a number of things. And remember, they didn't know who that belonged. They found it, but they didn't know who that belonged to for years. And the prosecution case is that it's 100 billion times more likely to be either of those two men than anyone else.
Yeah. Oh, looking forward to having all of this information kind of presented, all this evidence presented as the trial unfolds. I mean, at the moment we're getting the prosecution openings and had a few witnesses in this episode, though we're focusing on the prosecution openings because there is so much to get through. And in this point in the openings, this is really the prosecution outlining the evidence that they will present, telling a story of how they say this evening unfolded and, you know, trying to place, I guess, a bit of framework in the mind of the jury for how this trial will unfold. Liz, we do have quite a substantial charge sheet. You know, we have Steve Fabrizi, Joseph Ocone, the two men the police have charged with not just murder, a number of other offences in relation to these robberies through the late 90s. Can you take us through what they've been charged with?
Well, obviously, both are charged with murder.
Mm.
Some of the charge sheet relates only to Joseph Ocone because it relates to the 1998 robbery.
Got it.
And the police believe that he was involved in that and then subsequently in 1999. So some of the charges relate to that. With regards to the 1999 incident, Steve Fabrizi is charged with a number of things, for instance, trespassing and going in with a weapon. They're both charged with, like, their charges mirror each other.
Right, okay.
But there was at the very beginning of the trial, there was a bit of a surprise in that Steve Fabrizi pleaded guilty to being there, to trespassing with intent to steal. So he's kind of admitted he was there, but not that he was involved in the murder.
Mm.
So he's still pleading not guilty to that.
Right.
So it's a long list of charges.
Mm.
It's a complicated list of charges as well because one of the charges is, for instance, trespassing with intent to steal with a weapon because there was an allegation that there was a stick or something like that involved.
Right.
But there's a backup charge of, if you don't agree with that, trespassing with intent to steal without a weapon, you know, right. There's no weapon involved. So there's like alternatives.
Okay, right. And so this will be, I suppose, their options at the end of the trial if the jury is making their deliberations and they're sitting around thinking, well, look, I believe based on the evidence I've heard that, yeah, he was there. He did intend to steal, but he didn't have the stick. That's where they'll go. Is that right, Liz?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
It'll take them a while, I should imagine.
Yes, certainly with such a long charge sheet. So interesting to see how this all unfolds. I mean, Liz, we've been talking about the prosecution case against Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone for basically this whole episode so far. But there is a whole other, two other legal teams in this room as well. There's the defence teams of both Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone in there as well. Steve Fabrizi, you know, his barrister, Sky Jerome, it sounds like she was saying that Steve Fabrizi was at the house but never went inside. Is that the argument that the defence looks like it will be running? Is that the angle?
It is. Sky Jerome said in her address to the court, he was just the lookout.
Right.
Although he admits to going into the house at the very end when he says that Joseph Ocone had hurt himself in the bath as he was trying to climb out the bathroom window and he'd gone in there to help him get out, basically.
Right.
So that's one thing that he has admitted to.
Mm.
She also said, look, he's honest. He's been honest about being there.
Mm.
And she's taken aim at the DNA evidence and said, DNA is not conclusive evidence. This was a long time ago when this was collected.
Mm.
There are other, you know, there could be other explanations. DNA can easily be set aside in a case like this. So she's taken on the prosecution on all of their points about it. But there was one extra interesting bit.
Go on.
And this goes to two descriptions, one from Irma Palasik at the 1998 burglary and an account from Gregor Palasik during the 1999 burglary where there was a description of a young man with blonde hair and an Australian accent.
Okay.
Now, this is someone that Sky Jerome has raised in her opening of her defence, and she's asked the jury to consider that evidence as well.
Right, because we have heard in the openings that, you know, Steve Fabrizi is a Hungarian man. So he's a man who has emigrated to Australia from Hungary. The Palasics as well, Hungarian migrants coming to Australia to set up their lives here as well. And so it was the suggestion that, you know, if it had been these men, they wouldn't have had Australian accents. They were older. They would have sounded different. Is that the suggestion?
Yes, that's one of the suggestions. The fact that they've said that it was an Australian accent is one of the things that the defence has settled on. Another thing that was raised by the defence, and Travis Jackson, who's representing Mr. Facconi, raised this, is the description of the heights. So I think it was Irma. Both of them have said the attackers was about 165 centimetres tall, whereas Joseph Facconi is a very tall man.
Right.
So, like, he's over 6 foot. So but the prosecution says it was a stressful situation.
Okay.
You couldn't expect them to be, you know, spot on about their descriptions.
Mm.
And in both situations, 1998 and 1999.
Yep.
So this is something that the jury will obviously have to wrangle with.
Yeah. Oh, that's a, kind of incredible. There was all this conversation about, accents and Hungarian accents and all of that throughout the opening. So it'd be interesting to see how the defence frames that conversation about this idea of, you know, the potential, I guess, third intruder into this home and how that evolves throughout. I mean, Liz, we spoke earlier about the DNA evidence that, the prosecution has said it will present against Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Facconi. I mean, I was thinking about this actually as we were, you know, working through and doing the background of this story. And, you know, I think about DNA evidence so much because as I was growing up, the program CSI had just started showing on TV. And so this was our introduction into DNA evidence and how crime scenes were investigated. But at this point in the 90s, you know, this was just as that was happening. So I guess that was quite an early stage. How has the defense kind of tried to frame or, you know, explain how it might approach the DNA evidence?
Well, Travis Jackson told the jury this is not CSI and foreshadowed that, like Sky Jerome, he will be challenging that evidence. For instance, a simple example, you know, how did that DNA from Joseph Facconi get on to the balaclava? Well, the prosecutor pointed this out. He said that someone might have taken my balaclava and he'd used a balaclava for riding his motorbike. So he said someone might have taken it. That might be how my DNA got onto it. So there are other ways that DNA can be transferred to items. That's one avenue they've foreshadowed.
Mm.
But I think that this seems to be a significant battleground for all of the people involved in this.
Yep. Yeah. The other thing I noticed or we heard a bit about in the openings was that Joseph Facconi will be presenting an alibi for why he couldn't have been at the Palasik's house on that evening in 1999. I didn't realise that this was something that gets presented well in advance. So there's been a bit of preparation. The prosecution has had a kind of opportunity to look into this. And I mean, what have we heard about where he says he was on that Saturday?
Well, there's a number of explanations. One of them was that he went to work, but the prosecution said in the opening they could find no record of that, mainly because he did some manual labour for a firm. It was 1999, so there's no records left.
Yep.
Another thing he said was that he'd picked up his daughter from the hairdresser's where she worked, but the hairdresser that he said he picked her up from, she wasn't actually working there at the time.
Okay.
We're yet to hear more about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other very critical alibi he had was, which brings us back to the beginning of this, that it was the day we voted on the referendum on the Republic. The one record that is there is that he voted in Melbourne.
Right.
So, but the prosecution says if he voted early, there was still time to drive to Canberra by 8 o'clock in the evening. So it takes about 7 hours. So that's his one of the most critical bits of his evidence that he says, well, I was in Melbourne.
Yeah, okay. Liz, you know, both of these men who are charged for the murder of Irma Palasik and the other associated offences here are from Hungary, as we mentioned, as well as the Palasik. And there's also a translator in the dock next to Joseph Vicconi to make sure he can follow along through these proceedings. You know, trials can be very complicated. There can be a lot of language that may not be familiar, so I can understand the significance of that. Is that slowing things down, though? Does that take a bit more time?
It hasn't. I've seen worse. It hasn't actually slowed things down greatly. Mm-hmm. But the judge has given the translator a bit of a rest every now and again because it can get a bit intense. I suppose we're having more breaks, which is great from my perspective, but we're having more breaks than we possibly normally would. But actually, it's proceeded very smoothly.
Yeah, okay. Because, yeah, we are into some of the witnesses with this trial as well. We've spent this episode taking you through the opening arguments and statements just because they're so significant and they'll help you understand how this trial will be framed and how it's likely to unfold. And you know, as we continue, Liz, with this series, the case of the two intruders, we'll be kind of referring back to things we've heard through the openings as well. But, I mean, with those initial witnesses that we'll get into in our next episode, Liz, who are a couple of people that we've heard from so far? What kind of scenes have the prosecution taken us to as the trial has begun?
Well, we've heard from a lot of neighbours, some family members, but the most significant two people that we've heard from is one was Irma and a policeman read out her statement from 1998 where she describes what happened. Mm-hmm. So even though it was his voice, we could hear it in her own words.
Yeah.
The second person, of course, was Gregor. We've heard his 000 call where he was asking for the police, an ambulance to come and saying someone had broken in and they'd killed his wife.
Oh, dear. It's such a sad story, Liz. You know, this couple in their 70s enjoying a really quiet Saturday night and, you know, the whole life is just sort of torn apart after that. Gregor passed away in 2004, so neither Irma or Gregor are part of this trial. You know, we'll be hearing, as you mentioned, Liz, sort of, you know, vignettes of them, I suppose, through the other evidence that's presented here as well. Is there any family in the room witnessing this unfold?
Well, there's been a few family members sitting in the public gallery and, you know, you can only feel for them as they're hearing the voices or even just the words of people that they've lost in this, what was really a tragedy. There's no doubt that Irma was murdered. What this case is about, though, is whether it was Joseph Vicconi and Steve Fabrizi who were responsible.
Yeah. Liz, thank you so much for joining us on the case of the two intruders to take us through this story and to set us up for our coverage over the coming weeks. How long do we expect this trial will run?
3 to 6 weeks, I'm told. Yep. No one can put a better figure than that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a piece of string discussion at times, isn't it, when we talk about how long these trials will run. If you have any questions for Liz regarding the case of the two intruders, please get in touch. You can email us at thecaseof@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. Please keep your emails about the case of the Wheelie Bin murder coming as well. We have not forgotten about that. That trial's continuing. We'll be catching up with Eva to continue to bring you the latest on that trial as well. Also, don't forget to jump onto ABC Listen. It is a fantastic place to enjoy not just this podcast, but a whole range of other ABC content. So sort yourself out with that from your app store, and we'll be back in your feed on Thursday. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by Elizabeth Byrne and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri, Turrbal and Wurundjeri people.